Folks, if you enjoy our guidance about the management trinity, getting to know your people, talking about performance, asking for more, pushing work down, and our tools are helpful, one-on-ones, feedback, coaching, and delegation, the ideal way to learn about implementing them is to come to one of our effective manager conferences. One day, we cover all of the major topics. You practice feedback, you practice coaching, you practice delegation. I can't tell you the number of times people have said to us, wow, I thought I understood the tools. And then when I had to practice, I realized I've taken it to another level. Come to the website, check out our conference schedule, see us all over the US and in Europe and in Asia and in Australia. See you there.
Welcome to Manager Tools. Today's cast, the coaching model revised. In today's cast, we covered the first part of the Manager Tools revised coaching model. Here we go.
I'm actually looking forward to this cast. I it's amazing to me that it's been 4 years
since we rolled out the original, right?
Even though, really, I mean, the we've been talking about the new model for a couple of years, right? Since the conferences started.
Yeah, but this is the first time we're rolling out to folks.
We're casting. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, coaching. You know, I don't know. It's frustrating because it's so entirely powerful. But out of all the things we talk about in the Trinity, coaching has got to be the least often used tool that we talk about here.
Right. Yeah.
And there's some good reasons for it. They're sad, but, right. You know, one-on-ones, for example, you know, they're easy to understand. And once folks do them, every once in a while, there's some pain associated with it. But generally, folks really enjoy them. They get a lot out of their people. Their folks love them. They love them. And once they start, they never stop, right? I mean, that's the thing. Feedback, on the other hand, feedback's a challenge for many of us. It's uncomfortable. We don't like to give particularly negative feedback, right? And so it's uncomfortable. And there's enough pain associated with it that a lot of folks just never really get going on it. And we stumble around on it.
Yeah. And you know, the thing about you mentioned turnover. The thing that bothers me about the turnover thing is everybody's afraid of turnover. Like, oh my gosh, they'll think my retention numbers are low. But then everybody complains about not getting feedback, and they say, look, I didn't know enough, and if I'd have known how much you loved me, I would have stayed. And it's like, you know, dang. It's, anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Nobody likes conflict, right? So
yeah.
They avoid it like the plague. And then the issue is if we can't get through feedback, then it's unlikely that we're going to embrace the coaching. Feedback literally takes seconds. Coaching takes months, right?
Yeah. I think one-on-ones, once you get them in place, they feel good about them. They're like, wow, this is great, and I want to keep doing them. But you're right. Feedback is harder, and then coaching seems yet way harder still. I think, though, there's another reason that we're going to address here. Even though you and I both know the original model worked well, I've used it many times, it works great. The fact is, when we asked and we listened and we watched, it just became clear to us that it was too complicated for too many managers. Too few of us were using it, and yet you and I both knew. And look, we're all for selling our ideas if we believe we can do it ethically. I feel like my first iteration was, even though it's been used by thousands of managers out there in the field, and I've coached executives on it, and they've used it, and it works. The fact is, for whatever reason, we weren't terribly effective at getting it across, and it was too complicated. And so it's not that hard. But look, we're realists, right? I mean, the fact is, we believe management is a great calling. We're also realistic enough to know that almost no one else in the world thinks that.
Right.
We never thought that in 5 years we would change all of management. We thought maybe in 50 years we would do that, or the Manager Tools legacy would do that. We're realists, and you know, Horseman's Ninth Law is embrace reality. So what we've done here is we're sharing the new revised coaching model that we started to deliver at conferences, and simply we've been so busy and we've got so many podcasts in line, we never came back and redid it. And this cast simplifies the Manager Tools coaching model from 7 steps down to 4. And we believe it makes the concept more accessible. And if I could figure out a way to do it in one step that would produce results, that would move the peanut forward, we'd do it. We're not interested in impressing people with the cleverness of our ideas. We're interested in usable ideas that managers use create actions and behaviors, and it changes their results for the better, because that will cause other people to want to do it, and it will spread virally rather than only because some consulting firm is trying to become not the flavor of the month.
Yeah. Well, and the great thing about these four steps, these are four easy steps. I mean,
yeah,
none of them are complex. And frankly, they don't take a lot of time. But folks think about coaching taking, you know, hours and hours and hours with somebody. And literally, coaching can be done in 5 minutes during your one-on-ones with folks.
Right. Wendy and I have started a coaching engagement. I'm coaching her on sourcing. And we did all of the first three steps in 15 minutes today during our one-on-one.
Wow. And from now on, for the next several months while you're working on this coaching engagement, it's literally going to take 5 minutes during your one-on-one.
In the course of our one-on-ones. No special meetings, nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No special meetings, folks.
Yeah. And thanks to the Kindle, I discovered that a book that I ordered a while ago that I had recommended to her was available on the Kindle. So she got it and I got it. And we're both reading it. You know, we're not pitching the Kindle. We just, you know, just tells you it's not that hard. If you've got a Kindle, coaching is even easier, because surely books are going to be one of the resources you recommend to your folks.
Okay, so let's get right to it. So the coaching model is four steps. So obviously you have 4 points we're going to cover today, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just four. Now look, this is going to be a little bit longer cast, and we apologize for that. It's probably going to be two parts. We never know when we start, but there are 7 steps because we really want to go back. You know, a guy I respect once told me sometimes the things that go without saying still need to be said. And there's nothing wrong with us annually revisiting the core of the management trinity, because if every manager did nothing that we recommended except the trinity, we would in fact change management. We know that.
Right. If you haven't listened to the coaching podcast we did years ago, you don't got to go back and listen to this.
You don't need to.
And then listen to this. This is going to be self-contained, right? We're going to cover the coaching model in its entirety.
The only cast that we'd recommend that we encourage you to go back and listen if you don't feel comfortable with the tactics or the behaviors around it is the brainstorming cast, which is step 2 of the model, which we had not delivered when we did the coaching cast, but we refer to now quite frequently when we talk coaching at the conferences. But anyway, 7 steps. Point 1 is the purpose of coaching is to encourage, improve effectiveness. That word encourage is so important to us because it talks about the future, because all management is fundamentally about the future. Number 2, coaching is actually necessary, more necessary than ever, primarily due, but not the only reason, primarily due to today's discontinuous business environment. And step 3, we recognize that coaching has a terrible reputation. It's a shame. It's wrong. And we just want to state for the record, we understand it and we're not smoking crack. Okay. We know that you don't think coaching is great. We think you're wrong. We're respectful of your opinion. We know why you got your opinion. We'll share why that is in step 3. And then steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 today, or points 4, 5, 6, and 7, I'm sorry, are steps 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the model, which is step 1 is to collaborate to set a goal. Step 2 is to collaborate to brainstorm resources. Step 3 is collaborate to create a plan. And step 4 is the direct acts and reports on their success with the plan.
So let's talk about coaching and encouraging effectiveness, because this is often misconstrued by folks, particularly because of the history of coaching, right? Which typically happens. I get somebody in trouble and HR tells me, I got to coach the person. And, there's nothing encouraging about that.
Exactly. Yeah. We're going to have a coaching session and everything will be better afterwards. You know, why do I feel like I just got 5 lashes, right?
Yeah.
And let me just mention, in the show notes, which premium members know that is very detailed, essentially a script of the show if you want to go back and revisit it. In the show notes, we've got a picture of the four-step coaching model, which is just 4 boxes arranged at the 12, 3, 6, and 9 points of the clock, with arrows going in a circle somewhat from right to left, or clockwise, I'm sorry. And it says goal at the top, and then resources at 3 o'clock, plan at 6 o'clock, and act at 9 o'clock, and back to the goal at top. So you'll see that several times in the, not that that's a reason to sign up for premium content, but that's the picture Mike and I have in our head when we talk about
coaching. If that makes you happy and that's enough to get you to sign up
for premium content,
feel free.
Then by all means, please subscribe.
Support the show.
Yeah, this year has been interesting from a standpoint of subscriptions. We managed the business based on premium content subscriptions. And, it's been a softer year, 2009. And yet, we fundamentally believe that our future is in premium content subscriptions. So we encourage you to subscribe. We make no bones about the fact that we believe we deliver far more value than we charge for. And we believe that's the way to long-term business success. It may not be the way to overnight growth, but we're not worried about overnight growth because we've seen a lot of boom and bust cycles, including, to some degree, the one we're in.
Yeah. So what about that coaching?
Yeah, let's get back to coaching. Sorry. Coaching is the third pillar of the effective manager trinity. You and I, you know this, partner, we've seen lots of effective managers and executives. And what we know is that the vast majority of the best ones do three things really, really well. They have great relationships with their directs. They communicate regularly, almost incessantly, about performance, which their directs love, by the way. And they consistently ask for notably increased performance.
Wait a minute. I thought for sure you'd say there are the three things that all the best managers and executives we know do are one-on-ones, feedback, and coaching.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we try to talk about that at the first half hour of the conference, right, to lay the groundwork. They don't. They don't all do one-on-ones, feedback, and coaching. They all achieve the core concepts of direct great relationships and performance communication and increased performance. They all achieve those core concepts their own way. Though when you ask them in more detail, what exactly do you do? What are the steps? They look an awful lot like we recommend, but some of them don't call them one-on-ones, right? Manager Tools teaches one-on-ones because one-on-ones are teachable and effective in developing strong relationships. We can't teach developing strong relationships. That is an outcome. It is different for different people. One-on-ones are our way to help you get to developing strong relationships because one-on-ones are teachable and effective, and you can't teach developing strong relationships. We teach the feedback model because it is a teachable and effective way to talk about daily performance. And managers have told us over and over again, I want to, but I don't know how. And we teach this coaching model because it is a teachable and effective way to ask our directs to do more constantly. It is not enough to know that you need to ask your directs to do more the way head coaches in all the sports do and the way highly effective executives do. It's not enough to know it. We have to have a way to do it. And most managers say, I don't know how. And we read books trying to help us to know how, but the books don't tell us specific steps. Mike and I got tired of that years ago, and now we teach specific steps. We've never said great managers use the Manager Tools feedback model, but great managers absolutely talk about communication, about performance all the time, and many of them use a model that sounds very much like the feedback model. But don't confuse what you can read on the internet about one-on-ones or feedback or coaching, not at our site, but at others, because those aren't what the great executives do. Those are what some consultant says you might should do.
Right. Yeah, before we even get into the steps of coaching, I think we were talking about this the other week, and I think you agree that we've observed effective managers and executives, they approach coaching a little bit differently than most managers do, wouldn't you say? It's kind of a different tone.
Yeah. Look, I would say that most managers, in some level, we know we're supposed to get more from our folks. But frankly, we know we're not getting in trouble for not doing it, as long as we don't have too many of our people fail, and we have a person who does well, notably well, every once in a while, we're going to be perceived as being competent when it comes to managerial people development. And so most of us tend to take a pretty relaxed approach. And there's a part of us that's gnawing at us saying, you know, I should be doing more for my folks. I wish I had more time. And we rationalize the reasons why we don't have more time, which, of course, one of the reasons we don't have more time is because our people are constantly coming to us for stuff, which if we coach them more, they wouldn't come to us as often. But that's a whole other thing. I think the average guy, average manager, male or female, says, I'm too busy to spend a lot of time coaching. So I won't do it other than one of my top guys needs a boost, right, to get to the next level. Or one of my weaker performers needs to get above the baseball term, the Mendoza line, the line at which in your company it's a minimum standard. And if someone performs below it, evaluation starts saying things like termination could be in your future. I think you're right. But the problem is most of us are wrong. We focus on the top and bottom. Our top performers, because we feel like we need to do something for them, and our bottom performers, because we're afraid we're going to lose them or get in trouble for being a failure. We focus on the top and bottom for different reasons. And frankly, I would say that most managers aren't even sure that the reason they're doing it is right. And in that way, we are right, because the reasons we have for focusing on both of them are both wrong. I mean, it's terrible, but we know we're not exactly right, and that's the thing we're right about, is how wrong we are.
Yeah. And folks, don't feel too badly if you fall in this camp, because we've been done mm-hmm. it wrong many yeah. times ourselves.
Yeah, we don't hold ourselves out to be perfect managers. In fact, I'm learning about coaching again from coaching Wendy right now. So many of us coach our top performers because either we want them to do well and get promoted because we think they're great, or they demand that we coach them to do something developmental for them, and we're afraid we might lose them, and so we feel like we need to pay attention to their development. And unfortunately, the problem with that is that we think coaching is sending them to a class somewhere. On the other hand, for our poor performers, we coach because we're told we have to. Usually, I think, because of more fearful senior bosses who don't know what to recommend to coach on. I'll never forget at one of my clients seeing a big, thick, glossy box of the coaching box, and you open it up, and chapter 4 of 8 was, okay, in chapter 4, you coach. But it actually said that what you do in step 4, which is the coaching step of 8, right? Now, weird to have a coaching model that has 8 steps, only the 4th of which is called coaching. But in it, it said coach your employee.
Wow. Okay. That's helpful.
Yeah. And it was not expensive. I think these boxes were like $500 a person, and every manager had one. I'm like, that's a business I want to be in, until we have to, you know, hold our heads up and say it actually works, which it doesn't. So we're fearful, right, for our poor performers, and many of us think the squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of thing. We think that if we have the weakest performer, our weakest performer, above that Mendoza line, we'll look better, relatively speaking, compared to other managers, you know. And you know, some executive would say, hey, Joe manager here doesn't have anybody performing below par. He must be good, which, believe me, folks, that's not what executives think.
No.
It's completely false. In fact, the senior folks evaluating us often are just fine if one of us managers have a poor or significantly underperforming direct, as long as we have several very high top performers, because that's what they want the organization to produce, is top performers. And that, of course, is because of Managerial Economics 101, lesson number 2. Spending time with top performers produces more value than spending time with weak performers.
That surprised a lot of folks when they first hear it. You're suggesting the result of that rule is that you will spend incrementally more time, marginally more time with your top performers than your bad performers. And it's the bad performers that get us in trouble. So
right.
That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, that goes back to our whole thing of, you know, managers manage by exception, right? We look for the problem and then we manage the problem. And Drucker says, and so many other people say, no, you manage your opportunities. It's why First Break All the Rules by Buckingham was so powerful, because it says, don't manage to the weaknesses of your people, manage to their strengths. We do recommend that after our core investment in all of our directs, and that happens through one-on-ones, right? Our marginal choice about time spent with our directs be spent where we'll have the most impact. I mean, that sentence makes sense. If you have a choice about where to spend your time, wouldn't you spend it on the people or the resource that could deliver the most value for your company? Sure you would. Well, when you think about it for a minute, that's always our top performer. Every hour we spend with a top performer is going to return more value, both short and long term, to the organization than an hour spent with a direct who's not performing well. And, you know, you're right. That's different than what most managers think. Or at least it's different than how they behave, but it's probably surprising for them for that reason. But here's the difference, and we gloss over it to make a teaching point, which is we recommend that every manager spend time with each direct on a routine and regular basis through one-on-ones. And the fact is, too many managers don't do that, and if we're not doing one-on-ones, it's much easier to justify focusing on our weaker performers. Without the regulating effect of one-on-ones, we are much more likely to put out fires, managed by exception, as I mentioned, in order to reduce risk rather than increasing value. And I believe, Mike, I've not said this before. I didn't put it in the show notes, but I think this could be an ongoing thread for us and something we could expand upon. Too many managers have fundamentally conflated to be equal. They are related, but they're not equal. The idea that decreasing risk increases value. And those are two very different things.
Yeah, very different.
And simply because you decrease your risk doesn't mean you increase your value. Decreasing risk is a defensive thing. And if you're in a commodity business, great, decrease your risk. But there are less and less commodities in the world in many, many ways, thanks to human engineering and software and the internet and so on. And you've got to increase value and decrease risk both. And it's very hard to, and managers just believe, oh, I got rid of my risk, so therefore I'm okay. But that doesn't necessarily increase value. It just decreases risk.
Yeah. Not in today's world. You can't survive very long doing that in today's world.
Yeah, exactly. You just can't stake out a position and then just defend it, right? Because somebody will come along and build a better mousetrap. Pardon the ancient analogy there. Here's the thing, though. Let's go one step further. The difference with all this is highly effective managers are not looking for a way to minimize their interaction. They're not indifferent about development in terms of how much time they spend on it. I mean, the managers that I know that are highly effective and the executives that we know that are really impressive when you think back, every one of their people say, boy, she's tough to work for. Boy, he's tough to work for. They demand top performance. They talk openly about it. In fact, frankly, if I could change one thing about a lot of executives when it comes to demanding top performance, is I'd say, you know, you'd probably do fine having some of those conversations you have in the board meeting, in the boardroom, privately with some of the folks so you don't hurt their feelings. And they'd all look at me and go, Mark, look, these are adults. You know, they ought to be ready to get their feelings bruised every once in a while. But they expect top performance. They don't just encourage it. They reward it as well. And they also unreward or provide disincentives to those who don't make strong efforts at it. They know, highly effective managers know that if everybody's developing, results will improve and the organization is going to grow. And results improving and the organization growing, if they contribute in an outsized way to that, both of those outcomes are better for the manager. Either one of them is better, and they often happen together, and so both of them are even better synergistically for the manager. So look, it's simple. If you want to be a top-performing manager, if you have aspirations to be a top-performing manager or an executive, you have to be willing to improve the productivity of your team. That starts with expecting higher performance from each of its members. And the easiest way we know of that's teachable and effective to do that is to coach them using this model. It may not be the only model, but if you don't have another one, this is the one to be using right now. And it's not good enough. You're not being a professional and highly effective to say, well, I don't really like Mark and Mike's model. Look, you're not going to hurt our feelings. I don't really like Mark and Mike's model. I don't have another one. So therefore, I'm not going to coach.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. So let me ask you a question here about why it's so important. So let's say, for example, I'm in a job that doesn't change a whole lot. Let's say I'm in a factory and I make pins, right? And I figured, I worked with Frederick and he shared with me exactly how to divide up the labor. And I do this one little pounding step and look at, dude, I've been doing this for 10 years. I pound it the same way I did 10 years ago. And so there are jobs that exist that don't require a lot of change. So coaching to me seems probably in a lot of cases, probably not really necessary, right?
Right. Sure. Yeah. Feel free. You and Frederick, good luck. You know, God bless you. Look, your question is a softball, obviously. But no, obviously, it's not necessary to coach that person to improve. So you don't have to. But I can say this. When the company that comes up with a faster, better, cheaper way to produce higher quality pins and put you out of business, you could go, if you're the manager, you can go and say, look, I was wrong. I should have been asking you to improve. I know you're not a person who likes to improve. You don't like change. You like solidity. You like sameness. You like boringness at the office. And, you know, I gave you that. Unfortunately, we basically put off an enormously discontinuous moment that we saw coming 5 years ago. We didn't change because you didn't want us to. And then, of course, every employee would say, every person who is pounding pins would say, are you kidding me? That's what we pay you for. And you didn't do it. And it's a shame. It really, really is. Now, look, let's take a little different, more realistic approach, but it's only 10% different than what you suggested. What about the fact that, yeah, things change in the market, but fundamentally the market's pretty much the same year to year, small, low growth, and so on. You know, what we would say about that, about the environment that's not discontinuous is, for the day-to-day fluctuation that happens around us, but aren't enormous, that aren't quantum, that aren't orders of magnitude of change, just to deal with the normal organic growth, the in terms of the ongoing complexity we all live in, feedback is really the performance communication tool that gets us through that, right? The path we're on day to day is on paper pretty darn straight, right? But what everybody knows is the path of success is never exactly the plan. If you think it's exactly the plan, you're nuts. Okay. As I think Eisenhower said, planning is everything, but plans are nothing. Nothing is a straight line. Heck, quantum mechanics, the scientists who studied that say that even straight lines aren't even straight lines. So for the day-to-day changes, for the inevitable human errors, for the right intentions we all have when we go into the office that day and then things go awry and we miss deadlines and so on, for the evolutionary changes that we need, when it comes to performance communication and performance improvement, feedback is what we recommend for managers, right?
Yeah, but that's not the world we live in, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, if there's somebody out there who says, my world isn't changing, I would suggest then you've defined your world as to exclude everything that might impact your world. Because the fact is your world is changing. You're just not seeing it. It depends on how you define your world. The day-to-day performance feedback that comes in the feedback model does not address a flattening world. It doesn't address game-changing ideas like securitized mortgages, which may have been good at one time, but probably aren't thought that way now, even though I think there's reason to believe they could be good. We just made some mistakes. iPhones, nobody, you know, that's not an evolutionary thing. Even cell phones to begin with weren't evolutionary, I don't think. Or the internet, right? No, I don't know, in 1980, a bunch of people who were listening to me said, oh yeah, we're going to have an internet and here's what it's going to be like and Al Gore is going to invent it. Or email. I mean, nobody knew what, even if you knew email was coming, no one knew what a gargantuan swallower of time email would be. And that's multiple orders of magnitude right there. Small changes don't help the owner of a Taco Bell in Missouri in the United States who wonders why her sales are falling relative to her McDonald's competitor because she doesn't realize that the orders at McDonald's are being taken by phone in Colorado 800 miles away. You don't get in small steps organically from daily postal service in the United States or anywhere else in that world, in the world for that matter, to FedEx's overnight delivery, which Fred Smith brought us, you know, many, many years ago, headquartered in Memphis. You don't get in a few small daily steps from calling an airline to make a reservation or going to an airline reservation booth in a hotel that were staffed, you know, regular hours. You don't get from that to Expedia booking online organically. You don't get one person gradually getting better going from COBOL to DB2. You don't get to be good enough by switching to DB2 and then getting better at DB2 to address the impact of the universities in India that produced software engineers and the combination of that and transoceanic optical fiber to cause the outsourcing of code development. And that doesn't even address the fact that we have round-the-clock development teams now passing modules of code back and forth around, you know, chasing the sun, basically. And look, all the things I just mentioned, those things have already happened. Those are enormous discontinuities in the life of every single person that has been listening now. If those things have already happened, how can we simply say, I'm just going to do one-on-ones. I'm just going to do feedback. I already know there are discontinuities. I know that feedback is not enough. It won't make my people better fast enough. So how can we really stick with just evolutionary growth and setting annual goals and giving daily feedback? And the answer is we can't if we want to succeed. And this goes back to my old joke. I'm never going to let this joke go. I know it doesn't really go real well.
You're not going to talk about volcanoes, are you?
Yes, I am. Of course I am. Look, we joke that they make movies about volcanoes. Dante's Peak is the one I always think about, right? Pierce Brosnan. Heck, it had James Bond in it, right? We joke they make movies about volcanoes, but it's really the boring shifting of the tectonic plates, the continental shelf, right, that make for the mountains and the oceans on the Earth. Volcanoes are dramatic, and tectonic plates are boring. Good management is boring and unsexy and unpretty and routine and undramatic, so they don't make movies about good management. In fact, one of the best movies about business management and some of the things that go on in business was Disclosure, starring Michael Douglas. The book is brilliant, and of course, it was basically built around a backdrop of sexual harassment rather than about management. But the fact is, there are volcanoes. We believe in tectonic plate kind of management, but volcanoes do exist. And so we need a managerial behavior to address the dramatic moments that happen when suddenly a 2% improvement in our business this year is not going to be enough when our analog phone is competing against an iPhone, right? We need to ask for 5 or 10 or 15% more as a manager from each of our directs every year. And we need to do so all the time as insurance against our competitors popping their volcanoes, essentially. Plus, think about it this way. If our firm owns the volcano, we get the new cool thing or a better way of doing something, a better process, a reduced cost base or whatever. And then we ask for more from our folks. frankly, I think we're going to be, companies would be unbeatable, right?
Yeah. There's companies that do that. The Procter & Gamble's, the Intel.
Yeah.
The Johnson & Johnson's, the Walmart's, the world. They've been doing this for a long time. They're asking more from their folks, and they're leading their industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the way an effective manager asks for more is to coach her directs in the manager tools universe.
Okay. Well, we got to address, though, the reputation that coaching has with folks, because, frankly, it has a terrible reputation. People don't want to be involved in coaching because in the past it hasn't worked and it has a severe negative connotation to it. So we've got to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think there's a damaging view of coaching that we've all created, or if we didn't create it, we've nurtured it or we've allowed it to continue. It's like the broken windows theory. You walk by small little broken windows, and criminals do in big towns, and they think, oh, these windows are broken. Nobody's repairing them, and so I can make a big deal. There could be more crime here.
Let me say one thing, though, because I said coaching has a terrible reputation. It is somewhat surprising because when you talk to folks who played athletics, who are on some team, and they talk about their coaches in high school and college, there is a reverence there that is, it's almost like being in church. And so coaching in a lot of venues has a great reputation, and people talk about coaching with just these hollowed tones. But when you get into business, though, all of a sudden, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, we've really, I think it's safe to say we've corrupted it. You know, in the business world, being coach has an air of failure, right? It's desperation. It's the final steps that we go through because HR says we have to before termination. And I just want to say it again. This is not an accusation. Mike and I stand with everyone here, but we're responsible for this, folks. We are part of the management world. We're part of the business and organizational world. Large organizations are here to stay. It's part of mankind's natural tendency to organize into organizations. And when we don't coach and we don't address people who act as if coaching only happens at the end, we're allowing coaching to go from something that really was revered, to your point about being hallowed, to suddenly not so much. And that's too bad because it's a powerful tool. You know, when we all say, I guess I'll have to coach this guy before I get rid of him, you know, that's what HR tells me I got to do to dot my I's and cross my T's. That's adding to the impression. Our young people that are working for us, our new directs out of college or out of grade school, they're led to believe that coaching is somehow different for adults. And really, coaching has become the last act that we go through with half-heartedness in order to reduce our legal risk for a termination. You know, I think I've told this story before, but I'm serious. I know a young lady who worked at Walmart who came in late one day, and don't get me wrong, I love Walmart. I think it's a phenomenal story, and I think unfortunately, they've gotten a lot of bad press, and because it's a lot of people in one place, some of the bad press is deserved, but probably not as much as it gets. And she came in late one day for a busy day, pre-Christmas or something like that, and she was asked to come in the next day for coaching. And when she came in, she was given extra work as punishment, and she had to sign a form about being part of a team. It was clearly punitive. You know, imagine you're this young lady, you're not a college graduate, but you think I could have a career with Walmart. And of course, Walmart talks about high school graduates going on to have great careers, and many of them do, right? But imagine you're this young lady and your new boss, an effective manager, 5 years later says to you one day, hey, you're doing well, I want to coach you. I mean, look, she's entitled to be confused at that point, right? And maybe to be half-hearted about the coaching. Like, shoot, I thought I was doing good. You say I'm doing good, and here you are coaching me, and I have an association with punitive rewards, if you will, for that. It's stupid. It's wrong. And we need to start telling everybody who works for us, I'm going to coach you. I'm going to help you improve. It's not negotiable. It's part of improving productivity. And that's my job. It makes us better. I'm responsible for it with you. And here we go. Leave your preconceived notions at the door.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. We'll finish this one up next week. In the meantime, see you on the discussion forums, www.managertools.com/forums. Hope to see you there. So long, folks.